Okay. Yes, originally we planned this as a bit of comic relief, but I've been thinking, this program is about astrophysical outflows, and I promise you one heck of an astrophysical outflow. And actually, it might be of interest to 3D MHD simulation people. So I actually decided to give this talk on a serious level, at least part of it. It came from a magnetar. Magnetars, in brief, are neutron stars with very, very high magnetic fields. I mean, 10 to the 15th Gauss, not 10 to the 13th, not even 10 to the 14th, 10 to the 15th Gauss. Well, how they got to be that high, I don't know. And it's a little bit hard to believe, but...
Virial field would be, remind me, for a neutron star?
10 to the 17th, 10 to the 18th, something. It's nowhere near the virial field, but it's a lot bigger than the 10 to the 12th Gauss that we grew up on for neutron stars. And I wouldn't have believed it, except that there are several lines of evidence that, notably the one in this talk, most convincing, I suppose, that leave no doubt that the field has to be that strong. Okay, a brief history. Magnetars were hypothesized by Duncan and Thompson. Nobody took them all that seriously, considering, and to illustrate the point, consider that Chris Thompson had a hard time finding a job until 1998. On August 27th, 1998, the largest gamma ray burst, so to speak, at the time was detected. It was so powerful that it rocked the Earth's magnetosphere, and it lowered the bottom of the ionosphere. I mean, basically ionized the Earth's atmosphere to some extent. I mean, and at the time, it was considered an incredible event. Now we know that things were just getting warmed up. But at the time, it was almost unthinkable that an object 10 kiloparsecs away could be affecting life on Earth. But it did. And Chris Okolvietou measured the spin down rate and deduced a field of 6 times 10 to the 14th Gauss. Now, a lot of people don't believe that the spin-down rate gives you, with utter confidence, a magnetic field strength. You don't know that it's a dipole. You don't know that it's not mass-loaded. And there was a lot of resistance for many years. But we now see, we now have a direct measurement of the opacity from the short-term X-ray afterglow. And it really fits 6 times 10 to the 14th, not 3 or 2 times 10 to the 14th, but to within, as well as you can measure anything astrophysically, it's very much consistent with that field. And this was a magnetar called 1900 plus 14. It's not the one I'm going to discuss today so much. Well, so much for the history. Let's talk about the December 27th flare. It was much, much bigger than the August 27th, 1998 flare. It began with a rise time of about 2 milliseconds, at which point the electronics on most instruments got totally saturated and or blown away. And we know we have an estimate of the luminosity only by virtue of the smaller detectors that just happened to be on board for other reasons. We also know that we also caught the gamma rays reflecting off the moon. So, I mean, that's like inverse fourth power or something. It's two inverse squares. It was really powerful. It was brighter than the full moon. According to one referee, it was brighter than any solar flare, making it the brightest extraterrestrial flash ever recorded. But to be on the safe side, certainly the brightest from outside the solar system that I know of. It then had a tail that lasted several minutes, and you see it modulated by the rotation period of the neutron star. That's the tail is coming from trapped plasma. Notice that after the initial rise, it did go down for a spell and then went back up. I don't know what to make of that. The pulse profile began before the flare. It began it was one main peak. During the flare, it developed a second peak, which grew not quite to be as large as the first peak, but it grew considerably during the flare. So now it had two separate peaks, and actually there's a third one, a bit of a third one that also grew. And the fact that the pulse profile changes so much tells you that the magnetic field is probably reconfiguring in some way, or significantly changed. The spin down rate used to be 8. For about 12 months before the giant flare, there was a lot of bursting activity from the magnetar. And after the flare, it's been holding steady at about 2 in the units of 10 to the minus 12 hertz per second. The authors of this line seem to want to connect it smoothly. I would say that a sudden change, considering that there was, you didn't have any frequency measurements in this region, I'd say that these purple lines also fit pretty well, especially because I doubt that the spin actually increased. I think that the these two points are probably fairly level. But it would be nice if this happened again so we could... again, the total flare energy is 2 to 4 times 10 to the 46 ergs. That's a lot more than the rotational energy in the system. I can't imagine what's driving it other than the magnetic field. And if it is a magnetic field, it's got to be, even if you used up all the field energy, it would have to be at least about 4 or 5 times 10 to the 14th Gauss. You didn't use up all the field energy because there still seems to be a magnetic field there. And the magnetic energy that you get from the observed spin down is only about 5 or 10 times as large as the gamma rays that were emitted during the flare. And as I'm sure there was a lot of energy that was released that did not go into gamma rays. I'll be getting back to that. So a big chunk of the total reservoir of magnetic energy was bitten into during this flare. Now, given that the luminosity is about 10 to the 47 ergs per second, you can estimate that if the emitting surface was comparable to the surface of the neutron star, comparable to the total surface area of the neutron star, then you'd expect a temperature of about 200 keV. In fact, they saw a temperature of 175 keV, suggesting that the emission was coming from a sizable fraction of the neutron star surface. Now, how did you tap into such a large fraction of the magnetic energy and convert it to radiation? Why did it happen so suddenly? Why didn't it happen a day earlier or a year earlier? Obviously something had build up and then trigger the event. And why 100 times larger than the other two giant flares, which themselves were by far the brightest gamma ray flashes that had been observed to date. Now probably either the magnetic field breaks the crust of the magnetar, or the field was already souped up in the magnetosphere, sustaining a lot of magnetospheric currents, and then there was a field reconnection event in the magnetosphere. Each of those two would have a sudden bursty type coming on, and.
I'm sorry for interrupting, but can you remind me how we know the distance to this particular source?
We don't for sure. We don't for sure. There's some controversy over it, but there are molecular clouds that seem to stand in front of it, and they emit lines, and you measure their radial velocity with those lines, and that tells you. If you know an object is behind some clouds and ahead of others, and you know where the clouds are more or less, then you have a rough idea. Nevertheless, there's a factor of two controversy over it. Okay. Now, two models had been proposed, both long before the flare was observed. One I like to call a stress-relieving energy release. It's like a wound-up spring, a watch spring that suddenly snaps and unwinds quickly. I think that this sort of thing happens all the time, but I don't necessarily think it's associated with the flare. Now, I added, so about 4 in the morning, I added a slide on that. Doesn't seem to show up here, but the time scales work out fine. The millisecond time scale corresponds to light crossing time across the magnetosphere. I mean, it's obviously, that part is obviously triggered by a reconnection. But then the duration of several tenths of a second corresponds to the alpha crossing time across the star. And that suggests that the entire event involved a lot of crustal motion. It involved the magnetic field moving the crust. So the initial trigger was the magnetospheric currents relaxing, or at least starting to relax and triggering the rest. And then the crust. Moves freely for about 1 alpha crossing time. And I'll get to the tail. The tail lasted several minutes. That's also well understood. The other mechanism, which I like to call a stress exacerbating energy release, has a bit of a history, but it's something I propose might happen in magnetars specifically several years ago. In fact, I was in Santa Barbara at the time, and the title of the paper was, I think, very much inspired by being here. It was called Waiting for the Big One. And now, Flowers and Ruderman noted a long time ago that if you have a dipole field of the sort that we always think about in astrophysics, then if you divided, assume it's a fluid object, assume there's no toroidal field, assume it's perfectly symmetrical, then it's unstable, because if you divide the Oh, and assume it's non-rotating, and therefore perfectly spherical. If you then divide the object into half, and you rotate one half relative to the other, it's like two bar magnets. And it should be unstable. One side should counter-rotate relative to the other side, like that. And you should end up with a magnetic field reversal across the pole, and it's ripe for a magnetic reconnection right at that point. Now, since for many years nobody took this all that seriously, because how often do you see an object in astrophysics which has no toroidal field, perfect symmetry, and is totally fluid and non-rotating? Better question is, suppose it has a solid crust and a liquid core, then what happens? Anybody want to make a guess? Or an educated conjecture? I mean, on the one hand, since the ohmic dissipation time of a solid crust is many orders of magnitude longer, maybe 13 orders of magnitude longer than the dynamical time scale. If the inner part tried this counter rotation, it would just, the field lines would snag on the crust, and you'd be adding energy to the field. So that mode has to be stable. Similarly, since the solid crust is holding the fields frozen in on a dynamical time scale, then the magnetosphere during that time has no way of lowering its energy. So you might think it's stable. I think that's what would be my first guess. But I happened to have this really good student in 1986, we found the growing mode. And what happens is that on an ohmic dissipation time scale of the crust, it's very slow. The two central parts counter-rotate, and you just have to wait a long time for the vacuum part to hear about it, but eventually it does, and very slowly these fields get dragged through the solid crust on the ohmic dissipation time scale. So since this takes millions of years to happen, it's not very dramatic. The only relevant astrophysical consequence we could see was that dipole moments get destroyed without actually destroying the field altogether. It simply complicates the field, and we thought that maybe you could explain low mass X-ray binaries at the time, which seem to have lost their dipole moment, but on the other hand seem to have a magnetic field for some purposes.
Highest order is quadrupole?
Yeah. In fact, now
I was going to ask what the currents do in this situation.
I have lots of pictures. One thing that happens is the field line connects to the other side of the crust, so it exerts a stress on the crust once it gets started. Now, while it's in its symmetric state, it does not exert any stress on the crust. So it takes a while for the stress on the crust to build up. And that was the point. I mean, the one place where this could possibly is in magnetars, because the magnetic field is so strong that there's not going to be any differential rotation to maintain a toroidal field. That's for sure. And they have all the time in the world. I mean, if the field is complicated first, we can wait patiently and let it simplify until the field has enough symmetry for the instability to go. And the idea is that even if it happens only once or twice per magnetar, we should be able to see them at least from other galaxies, because the energy release would be extremely bright. So you get stress on the crust. if it goes to completion, then yeah, you develop this sort of final field structure, and you have two poles per pole, so to speak. And you might get an extra peak in the pulse profile. Now, if there's a slight toroidal field, if there's a strong toroidal field or even comparable to the poloidal field, it will stabilize the instability. If there's a weak toroidal field, then the instability goes, but not to completion. You just sort of get, you split the pole a little bit, and then the internal toroidal field gets stretched by the counter-rotation enough, and then it just stops and stays where it is. At least I think that's what would happen. Now, a stress-relieving process is stabilizing, and it can be a local event, and it can be any size, and it simplifies the magnetic field geometry. I don't see that it provides any direct answer to some of the questions raised by the December 27th event. On the other hand, if it's stress exacerbating, well, that's a true instability, and it doesn't stop. It just doesn't stop going until a sizable fraction of the entire magnetospheric energy is used up.
Can I ask, why does it stop with a quadrupole? Why doesn't it just keep flipping and eliminating the field?
Well, actually, it doesn't. Once you have a quadrupole, that's a symmetric situation again. It doesn't stress the crust, but again, on another ohmic dissipation time scale, it would be unstable to forming an octopole. And I think with an octopole, it actually does stop. But that's assuming perfect symmetry. Generally speaking, if you imagine there's going to be a slight toroidal field or a slight finite amplitude perturbation that's left over from the inception of the magnetar, it can get hung up, you know, before it completely flips. And I think that's probably what happened here to some extent, because this is a young magnetar, and it probably had some initial condition that helped it get started. And of course, it complicates the magnetic field geometry. So the point is, as impressed as I was by the August 27th event, it predicted that there would be possibly a new class of soft gamma ray repeater outbursts that would be 100 times the size of that event.
So there's a spectrum of where different amplitudes.
Yeah. So far there are two. There are two at 10 to the 44, or twice 10 to the 44, and one at 10 to the 46.
So
100 times larger.
These extremely bright flares are the best that one can do, or on an extrapolation. And I thought there was this whole point that the flares look like they follow.
No.
Number versus flux.
No. You're talking about the very small ones,
okay,
which are
these are
like, they're called giant flares.
Yeah, sure. But I'm asking, are they on an extrapolation?
Well, there are only three of them.
Right.
And
the usual number is 1 per 100 years.
It must be more frequent than that, right? Because there are only three SGOs known. We've seen them all flare in the last 25 years.
Well, there are four SGOs known. So we've seen three out of four. Three out of four in 25 years. So it's probably one per magnetar every 20 years or so. Except that this thing, I think it happens much less frequently. What?
Do these giant flares
lie on the earthquake relation?
On that relation?
On the earthquake relation. The soft repeater bursts themselves.
Oh, I don't know.
What's this frequency?
I don't know, but I... If they do, it's by luck. I mean, it's small number statistics in any case. I mean, I don't think that the December 27th event and the two other giant flares lie on any one line because if it's 100 times larger, it should have been much rarer, and yet we saw it within more or less the same time interval. And I think part of that was just dumb luck, frankly. So I haven't even thought about this, statistics. Yeah. Now, the this is the August 27th event. Notice that the magnetic field pattern simplified during the flare, during the giant flare, and it stayed simple.
What's been
positive? X-ray is a function of time, but it's cyclic. You're seeing a pulse profile as the X-ray pulsar sweeps across your line of sight. And it went from multi-peak to single peak. So it's like the higher multiples were gotten rid of and it left the dipole. But for the December 27th, I don't actually have the before and after, but the before picture is you saw just this one main pulse. And within 25 seconds, it started growing a second one. And after a few minutes, it had already... And this is where it stands now. This pattern is now the new pulse pattern.
So is this a photosphere?
No, this is, now I'm getting to the tail. After that hard spike that lasts 0.2 seconds, you get a tail that's rotationally modulated for several minutes. And where does that time scale come from? Well, it's a trapped pair of photon plasma. It's opaque. It's like a blown up balloon that's leaking air, but it's leaking out at the Eddington luminosity. Now, what's significant here is that the tail in both cases were comparable. This tail was not 100 times brighter than the previous one. It was the same. So the balloon strengths are comparable, and the rate of air leakage is the Eddington luminosity. That's comparable in all cases. And the duration is easily estimated from the energetics, knowing the Eddington luminosity. The Eddington luminosity in this case it's obviously more than the usual value because the Thomson scattering opacity is reduced by the magnetic field. And this provides a crude measure of the magnetic field strength. There are other the short-term afterglow, which lasts several hours, provides an even better but very similar type of constraint. You basically measure the opacity based on how long it takes for the pair energy to leak out as photons.
So in giant flares with very different power in the giant flare itself, energy in the tail?
Is the same, as far as we can tell, yeah. Because... No matter how much energy you released originally, the magnetosphere couldn't contain it. It can only contain about this much energy. So for the other flares, it can only contain 10^44.
We can't see where you're pointing. Your finger doesn't show up.
Oh right. this is about what it can contain. Here you estimate that the field is at least 10 times the QED critical field. Anyway, so much for the tail. That, by the way, is also sort of a reassurance that we're not overestimating the distance by an order of magnitude, because it all makes sense. The tails are the same, which you expect.
Sorry, David, I mean, I hate to continue asking stupid questions, but on the previous slide when you showed the evolution of the pulse profile, that was during the tail, though, right, or not?
Let's just go back.
Yeah, so not there.
Well, first 25 seconds, that's during the tail phase.
So the pulse profile is becoming more complex with time, but this is on a long time scale. So is this because
that's
the
right.
Is revealing the complexity of the higher order multiple?
What? Possibly. Possibly the dust is settling. I have to admit, I really don't know. But that's as offhand sounds like an intelligent guess. It could be that the field was actually changing on this time scale. But I like your idea better, that it that the dust was settling. I'm not sure it holds water, but I like it. Anyway, the time scale for this amount of energy to leak out at the Edenkin rate is of order minutes. And the spectrum during the tail phase, as you might expect, was much softer because there was much lower luminosity. Okay, now we come to the astrophysical outflow that this caused. Well, there's a sad story here. For the first week after the flare, the VOA allocation committee would not give the observers time to look at it. Their reasoning was that for the August 27th flare, the radio afterglow didn't peak until 10 days after the event, so that'll probably happen here too. But when they first looked, it was apparently already past its peak, and thereafter decreased sharply. It decreased almost as t to the minus 3, which is much steeper than a GRB afterglow, and it's probably some, the debris of an early collision that was adiabatically expanding in, say, 2 plus epsilon dimensions. Let's say ram pressure confinement confines it in the third dimension. Then you can explain the steep decline very well. And it kept declining. And yet, and I hope I have this in the right, No. I want to show it to you the way we had it, with the data dribbling out day by day. See, it got off to a fast start. And I'll get back to this, but actually it started expanding linearly. Now here's this thing that's dimming like crazy, but it's growing linearly with time as if it's coasting out. This is like Jim Brown running through a line of kindergarten kids. I mean, and that's not a forward shock, because a forward shock in this situation gets brighter with time, and this is yet the luminosity was declining like crazy. So we figured eventually the forward shock has to start dominating at some point. And we sent the observers an email saying that, according to our rough calculations, we haven't entered the set-off phase yet, but it'll be happening soon. So for the next few days, beat on the VOA allocation committee. Let them, give you time every day to follow this thing. And a couple of days later, Brian Gensler wrote me back and said, why should it start to get brighter? And this was January 26th. January 28th, we get an email, subject SGR 1806-20 is brightening. And indeed, it was. You got a rebrightening bump, and it continued expanding linearly until about days 30 to 40. And by around day 40, which is 1, 2, 3, by around here, it's just starting to decelerate. Okay, now this bump, wait a minute. Let's just go to the... So basically, what we figure what happened during the first week, you had the ejector were coming out even faster, or maybe at the same speed. They hit a pre-existing shell that's that may have been relativistic matter that sort of like the hare and the tortoise. The relativistic matter gets out a little bit faster, but since it has less energy, it also poops out faster, and then the slower matter behind it comes and hits it, and they all come continue out at the speed of the tortoise. And then it goes for a while, but eventually the tortoise gets slowed down and it starts decelerating. And the coasting phase, if you have two-dimensional adiabatic expansion, the volume so goes as t squared or so, you get the right power law decay. But once it starts decelerating, you expect the energy from the forward shock to start peaking, basically. Because once it starts decelerating too much, then even the forward shock declines with time. So the peak of the forward shock comes just at the beginning of the deceleration phase, and you get a pretty good fit to the rebrightening bump. And this is significant. I mean, it's not just that we want to fit this data. We want to know what the ejector was. And the fact that it coasted and then decelerated is significant. And the fact that it rebrightened is significant, because if it had been purely relativistic matter, there would be no scale on the problem. It would never rebrighten. We think that the best reconstruction of the data is that you had an initial early impact, a coasting phase in which you were seeing the fossil synchrotron from this early impact, and then eventually, around the time of rebrightening, the forward shock takes over. But the significant thing, now first of all, this allows us to make an estimate of both the mass and both the rest mass and the energy of the outflow. Keep in mind that this is the only gamma ray burst afterglow, so to speak, that you can resolve spatially. So you can make a simple dynamical estimate from freshman mechanics if you know that's proportional to the ambient density. It's just the mass, which is n times r cubed, times v squared, and that ends up being at least the order of 10 to the 44 ergs. But we really don't know n that well. Who knows? Maybe for some reason this thing went off in a cavity so tenuous that n was even smaller than in the hot phase in the interstellar medium. But there's another way to estimate the mass and energy, and that's just from the way they do it for gamma ray burst afterglows, which is you parameterize the field and the energy in the electrons. And in this case, it depends much less sensitively on, it doesn't depend on V to the fifth power, but rather V to some fractional power. And what we did here is basically combine the luminosity and kinematic estimates in such a way as to minimize the uncertainties. Sort of like the way microeconomists minimize the uncertainties in cost based on market fluctuation.
Now
it makes sense.
You do a little algebra, but get these exponents basically the more uncertain the parameter is, the smaller the exponent you want it to depend on. And so we don't know the density very well, but it depends on, we got it to depend on, in this expression, on density only to the 0.2 power. We don't know the fraction of shock energy that gets converted to field very well. But we know that 10 to the minus 1 would be generous. And if it's less than that, that only raises the mass and energy estimate. And same thing with the electron. So we can say with confidence that the mass ejected had to be at least of the order of several times 10 to the 24 grams, which is a lot. And the energy had to be at least several times 10 to the 44 ergs per second, which is which is 1% of the gamma ray energy. So it starts. It's still probably lower than the gamma ray energy, but it's starts to look a lot like the relative proportions in gamma ray bursts. Gamma ray bursts typically, at least the way I figure it, put out about 7 times as much energy in gamma rays as in afterglow blast energy. So the blast energy is about 15% of the gamma ray burst energy. And here too, this is probably compatible with 15%. Certainly 5 or 10%. Now, another thing is that the centroid was moving. It was hard to measure at first. The VLA can measure the size of something more accurately than it can measure its position. But given enough time, they were able to put an estimate on the centroid velocity. And it ends up being just about slightly less than half of the expansion velocity, of the end-to-end expansion velocity. So the centroid moves at about 0.26 C, and the end-to-end expansion velocity, the rate of change of the diameter of the object, is about 0.7 C. So half of that would be 0.35, and 0.26 is almost half of that. Some of the observers on the team seem to think that this supports a one-sided ejection. I think the centroid velocity would be exactly half if the thing left a trail that was uniformly luminous from the front end to the source. I don't see why debris left at the point of origin should be as bright as the leading edge. And I would think that if it were completely one-sided, the centroid velocity would be almost or even more than the expansion velocity, because you have a compact thing moving. As long as the size of the size of the emission region is less than the distance from the original source, then the centroid velocity is larger than the expansion velocity, but certainly larger than half the expansion velocity. Not by the VLA. Although, when the VLA reconfigures to high resolution next January, it will be resolvable. It is, but I agree. It's hard to say. And even within the team, we've been arguing about it over the past week. The observers seem to be pretty confident that it's one-sided. And I think a better fit is to say that it's asymmetric but two-sided. Because if it were one-sided, the centroid velocity would be somewhat larger. But all these conclusions are to within 1.5 sigma. To 3 sigma, it could be two-sided and symmetric. Well, it was at the beginning. And Merlin was ostensibly looking at it. But the problem is that Merlin is in England, and very few people in England are interested in magnetars. So I'm not really sure what's going on, frankly.
No.
Yeah, there.
You even skipped your talk.
Yeah, no. We were visited by a rather prominent British astrophysicist recently, just a couple of months ago, and he hadn't even heard about the event at all. I thought that was kind of amusing for us. Anyway, what can we learn from all of this? What is the explosion ejecta made of? Well, charge neutrality demands that it either be an electron-positron pair or atomic nuclei and electrons. I can't think of any other possibilities offhand. But if it were pure electrons-positrons, it would be relativistic and it would not fit the outflow data. So we conclude that it's because it's, the expansion had a coasting phase in which it was both steady and subrelativistic, we conclude that there's honest to God rest mass there. And what that means is that the outflow is baryons. And that means that if there were internal shocks in the baryons on the way out, you would get pions and neutrinos emitted. Now, you could say that about anything. I mean, lots of things emit baryons. The thing is that this was about five orders of magnitude brighter than bright gamma ray bursts. And so if you're talking about seeing neutrinos from gamma ray bursts, which is something that I considered 13 years ago and decided it would be pretty tough. Here, on the other hand, you have a far better opportunity to see neutrinos from a very similar event. So I'm just waiting with bated breath to hear what Amanda saw, if anything. So far, it's been 6 months, and I haven't heard anything. But if you're going to see neutrinos from something, it really ought to be this. I seem to be at the conclusions. Okay. I just want to say you've been very good about not testing me with questions, but although I've been busy preparing the talk and jet-lagged until now, but those conditions were temporary, and my door is always open if you want to talk about this or anything else. But anyhow, the conclusions, first of all, this thing was about 10 to the 7th times brighter than typical gamma ray bursts, and about 10,000 times brighter than the really bright gamma ray bursts. It would be hard to think of more than one or two or three gamma ray bursts that were within four orders of magnitude of this. And yet, in many ways, it's remarkably similar to a gamma ray burst. So it really ought to be of interest to a lot of people. Anything we can expect from the gamma ray burst, we should really look for from this event. And the thing is, we expect to be able to see this, at least the radio afterglow, for about another 10 years. So we get to see it both spatially resolved and in lifetime. And that's very rare in astrophysics because usually when something's far away, usually it's either, if it's big enough to resolve, then it's took a long time to get that big, and vice versa. If you can see it in real time, you usually can't resolve it. But here we can do both, and we can see whether it's going to get collimated with time. It's quite a prospect. I think that 3D, we have enough hints from the one-sidedness. We'll get the one-sidedness and the asymmetry is still a little bit unclear and debated, but there seems to be a little question that it will clarify within the next year or so. And between the geometry of the ejecta and the pulse profile and the spin down behavior, I think there'll be enough data that to pose a significant challenge to any MHD expert that wants real data and wants to explain it in detail. And I'm specifically mentioning that as a challenge to this audience. And finally, as I already said, The outflow, very rare in astrophysics, can be both spatially resolved and followed in real time in the coming years. So I suggest that in a few years from now we have another program here on astrophysical outflows in Santa Barbara. I seek to have a few more minutes, so I think I'll close with, I promised you some comic relief. Okay. There is one thing that just is not making sense about this entire event. You really ought to be able to see this thing from out to a distance of 70 or 80 megaparsecs. It would look like you wouldn't see the tail, but you'd see the first 0.2 seconds easily with SWIFT. It should look like a short gamma ray burst. And in my paper a few years ago, I suggested that SWIFT, I mean, I was expecting that would be the only place you could see it. I mean, who would have thought that the very first burst that they saw was from our own galaxy? The odds of that were like 1 in 10,000. And especially a month after SWIFT turned on, I mean, that was really dumb luck. But it's been many months since then. It's been about 8 months since then. SWIFT should be able to localize short gamma ray bursts very accurately. And no question that Neil Gehrels and Dave Palmer are very keen on that whole project. The silence is deafening. They localized one short burst. And they've also localized about five others from triangulation, not even using SWIFT. None of those five coincide with any galaxy from 100 megaparsecs, as far as I can tell. Our neighbors are deafeningly quiet when it comes to these kinds of outbursts.
So SWIFT, the number of short bursts, period,
is disappointingly low.
Lower than expected. Well.
Well, they didn't expect to see as many as Batsy.
It looks smaller because compared to the other logs. The logs which are for the young size.
Anyway, it's maybe a little bit too soon to make this statement, but in a few months, if things don't pick up, and here's the comic relief part. We might seriously consider the possibility that our galaxy has more magnetars or more active magnetars than most others. What?
We don't know the distance and we don't know the recurrence.
We know that we can. We know that.
Well, I mean, the estimate.
The distance of what?
The estimate of what fraction of short GRBs depended critically on knowing the distance. And if it's unturned to a factor of 3, that's the big effect. And it depended on knowing the recurrence constant, which we have almost no clue.
Well, the distance is uncertain by a factor of 2, and if it's a factor of 2 closer, then that would lower the expected number by a lot. And that's right. That we don't know the recurrence time.
Thousand years? Come on, that's
so antiquated.
That's 10%.
No, well, I mean that.
No,
but of this size, we've only seen one.
Yeah.
The point is,
it just happened to be during.
If you go to a bus stop and a bus stop comes in 10 minutes, the recurrence time is not 1,000 years, probably.
That's right, but you can have your pick of anti-Copernican solutions, but it's either in time or possibly, possibly it's just dumb luck. I mean, I was answering 100 emails a day, and I got repeated strain injury from it. So I could say, well, you know, things may be too good to be true, but nothing's too bad to be true. And but there is the possibility that I actually meant to look into this further. I'm a little bit ill-prepared, but if the Magellanic clouds are bound to our galaxy, it is an unusual situation. Most galaxies do not have bound partners on such low angular momentum orbits that interact with the galaxy as much as ours does. And it could be that our galaxy has more star formation than most of the same size. That would not be what? I know. I knew you were all going to say that, but we don't know. We don't know the. First of all, the last encounter with the Magellanic clouds was 100 million years ago, right? Or thereabouts. You're not going to see any really young star populations or enhanced supernova rate that were triggered by the last encounter. Of what? What about close to the center? I don't know. I know that. I know that, and it's a problem. But I'm not saying it's two orders of magnitude higher than average, but a factor of several higher than average is. I don't think can be confidently ruled out. I mean, how accurate do you claim you can measure the overall star formation rate?
Why do you want to measure the star formation rate?
No, it just.
I think we should debate this offline.
Okay. But one thing is that.
You got a question.
Okay.
You want to
answer? Well, I've already gotten myself into enough trouble, so I'm not going to finish. I'm not going to finish the sentence. Go ahead.
When would you expect to see the neutrino signal?
Last December.
Yeah. So at what point do you...
So they didn't see
something
it?
Something else would be... At what point do you start constraining what the output would be?
From what? The absence of
the
neutrinos? Oh, well, you know, we'll just say that... we'll just say that there just didn't happen to be a big internal shock. In that outflow, or you know, you never know. We may eat our words and say we were wrong about something. But first, I want to hear the upper limits, because my point wasn't that we should confidently see neutrinos from this. My point is that they should be. About three orders of magnitude brighter than from a bright gamma ray burst. Amanda could have seen, I would say if 1%, maybe, the problem was it happened during the daytime. So the muon background was much higher than if it had waited another 12 hours. So it may be that you can only say that less than 10% of the total went into neutrinos, and that won't be much of a constraint. If you constrain it to 1%, then we'll probably say, well, there weren't too many internal shocks. They constrain it to 0.1%. That'll be interesting. But so far I haven't heard, I don't think the upper limits are going to be that low. Because it happened during the daytime. Yes?
David, what it sounds like you're really saying is that if we don't see neutrinos from Amanda in this event, we may be on our way to a new record in the number of dollars spent per detected anything in an experiment.
We should count all high energy neutrino detection experiments. I forgot.
Well,
one will have to see something. I have a serious question also, which is that if you take a simplistic view of the spin-down index, it's related to the multiple character of the field.
That's right.
And so do you think there's any plausible expectation that by looking at the spin-down history of this object, you could actually see a change in the field geometry?
Well, let's see. That was one of the transparencies.
I came in late. Maybe I missed it.
Okay. Well, I'll show it again, Julian.
And I saw a spin-down rate, but you didn't actually compute the dimensionless index number.
I'm not sure what you mean.
I don't think there's a...
Oh, the breaking index?
Yeah,
that's not...
I don't think we have an accurate one. But...
You mean the second derivative?
Right. That's what I was wondering.
But the thing is... The thing is, I mean, you can interpret the data several ways. I mean, it certainly seemed to be about 8 here at a steady level, and it's gone down to about 3. And holding steady. Now, what happened in the 12-month period between this steady period and that steady period is pretty murky. I mean, several things could have happened. One is that this added spin down could have been a result of bursting and extra plasma ejection or whatever.
Something different. Which is that there is the rate of change in the spin down tells you something about the multipolar character of the field. That's kind of long term object. We're not talking simply.
Yeah, but here's my point, Julian. During all this time, in magnetars, they're very bad clocks. The spin down is itself erratic. Yeah, the spin down is itself erratic for reasons that are not fully understood. But we think it has to do with helicity bleeding into the from the crust into the magnetosphere. Anytime helicity bleeds into the magnetosphere, you get a slight distortion of the dipole field, which actually makes it go slower than r to the minus 3. It goes as r to the minus 2.9 or something. And that actually enhances the rate of spin down. And that's the sort of thing that happens spontaneously with absolutely no bursting behavior associated with it. And I guess I must have sent the... I had a really nice slide of that, which some...
I was just hoping there'd be some actual diagnostic that you might use to detect a sharp change in the geometry of the field.
What you'd look for is change in the spin down, in the spin down rate. I mean, there's no question if you lose a dipole moment, if you lose 30% of your dipole moment, there should be a quantum jump in the spin down rate.
What I remember from other papers by Chris, don't worry, you might remember better, it's the claims of using the post-pulse protocol change in protocol information.
Oh, yeah.
To argue that you're seeing a change in the multipolar.
That's certainly true,
And in fact, they showed
it. Yeah, right. That's right. But in the other...
But in one case, it's simplified, and in this case, it complexified.
Yeah, exactly.
Any other questions?
I would like to ask the question about the state of the dense matter.
The what?
The state. State of the dense matter. There's a big debate, different sort of constituents in magnetars, neutron star, whatever. Strange stars and can this particular object help us to sort of dig out some information about the equation of state?
Well, I think it's one more nail in the coffin for bare strange quark stars. It certainly doesn't. If we can eventually show that that there was a magnetic instability in the core, that would suggest the core was a liquid, a superfluid rather than a solid, and that would rule out. Well, I'm not sure. No, I'm not sure that would what that would rule out. Rule out white dwarfs, but that's not too interesting. I'm going to give another talk in a few weeks in Vancouver about that aspect. Magnetars seem to be made out of normal material, as best we can tell, because there's intermediate X-ray afterglow, which lasts for several months, and in one case, several years, which is nicely explained if you assume that the crust is made out of normal material with 10 to the 15th Gauss, as opposed to strange quark material with 10 to the 15th Gauss. No. No. If they accreted, you wouldn't know they were magnetized. The X-ray bursters are not the magnetized.
Is there a fundamental reason for that, or just happens there just aren't that many?
All the things that we've identified as magnetars, the anomalous X-ray pulsars and the SGRs, and not accreted. They don't have companion stars. Well, that was a model for them for some time, for the AX.
Yeah, because everybody assumed that they were accreting, but the thing that makes them remarkable is that they're solitary. And that's how you know that all their emission is driven by a magnetic field.
My question is that thought to be a fundamental property, that you need to be solitary to be a magnetar, or just so happens that the numbers of them are few enough, we don't happen to see one in the binary?
People argue that half the neutron stars in the galaxies are magnetar, in the galaxy are magnetars, so I don't...
Yeah, no, I think it could be... I mean, I don't even know why they form in the first place, so nobody can really say too much from first principles, but...
Darwin used to be that there's no obvious reason why they shouldn't form.
Magnetars are binary.
They watch the magnetic field stop at 10 to the 12. Stop at 10 to the 18 and blows the star apart. But what was special about 10 to the 12 versus 10 to the 15 guys? Those seem to be a fairly good argument.
Well...
You think 10 to the 12 you can kind of get by flux freezing, 10 to the 15 requires a more complicated dynamo.
You can actually get 10 to the almost 10 to the 15th with flux freezing if you start with a magnetic white dwarf 10 to the 9th. So how did you get 10 to the 9th in the white dwarf? I don't know. Then maybe it was an MRI.
Unbound?
Yeah, I don't think there's any
arc
principle there. Okay, thank you, David.